Did you ever notice that in our dearest folk tales, the heroes and heroines are often reluctant to take on leadership? In The Sword and the Stone, the future King Arthur is reluctant to rule because he doesn't feel smart enough. In the Hebrew Bible or Old Testament, God reaches out to Moses through a burning bush and says, "Moses, get your people out of Egypt." And Moses says, "Oh no, I stutter. I can't do that." Our first president, George Washington, had no interest in being president of the United States, but after a lot of coercion, agreed to the role. In a letter to a close friend, he wrote, "Now I know I have no future, I have no future chances of happiness." And he hoped that people weren't too disappointed in him as president. He felt he was embarrassing his family, that he would be tainting the name of Washington. He said all he could offer was enthusiasm and zeal for the new country. This is the only president who was ever elected unanimously by the Electoral College. In The Hobbit, Bilbo Baggins would rather not go on a quest. He likes living in the Shire, and he doesn't want a chance missing one of his meals, first breakfast and second breakfast, first lunch and second lunch. He's not the adventurous type. But reluctant or not, our tales teach us that the most reluctant leaders, those who feel the least qualified, those with deep wells of humility, make the best leaders. Has anyone ever worked with a personal trainer? Personal trainer at the gym. Yeah. A personal trainer leads you in exercises to maximize your strength, to advance your endurance, to be as fit as you can be. A trainer pushes you to try harder than you want to try. You pay a person to make you do work you don't want to do, to see past your own limitations, to make and meet goals. And when you join this congregation, you not only get a terrific church family, but you get me as your personal spiritual trainer. I am here to push you to explore new depths, to discover how wide your heart can stretch, to strengthen, to maximize your spirit's endurance. And over the next few weeks, we're going to work on building your hope muscles, your hope endurance. And sustainable hope is our goal. Because whether you know it or not, it is time for us to shake off our notions of an ordinary life and embrace our identities as Shambhala warriors, the reluctant, peaceful warriors that Susan just described. Shambhala warriors use two implements, compassion and insight into our interconnectedness. Shambhala warriors arise when all life on earth is in danger, when all leaders are corrupt. And as Earth Day arrives this week, I'm sure you don't need me to remind you that all life on this planet, human most certainly included, is in danger. I'm not going to repeat all the facts to you because I know you've heard them before. Salmon migration is blocked by dams, and the Earth's warming, which starves the orcas, and something's going on with the starfish, but we haven't figured it out yet. And the waters are rising. Seattle might eventually be underwater. Nature is in big trouble, and we're realizing that nature isn't something out there, like that you go see in a national park on vacation. Nature is us. California is nearly out of water. California is where our produce is grown. Being at the top of the food chain won't be so great when there's nothing left under us to eat. As the web of life is torn asunder, our leaders, who are technically elected by us but unfortunately beholden to donors, deny that anything is wrong. They don't want to mix science into public policy because Exxon wouldn't like that. And so, my beloved spiritual companions, we have to transform into spiritual warriors. Like George Washington, like Bilbo Baggins, I would rather stay home and play with my dog and hang out with Jay reading novels on the couch and putter in my tiny garden. That sounds just fine, but we're in real trouble here. the whole Shire, the whole earth. And unless we act, human life could actually become extinct. As extinct as a Tyrannosaurus. And so we become Shambhala. Raise your hand if you feel overwhelmed by the destruction of our planet. Raise your hand if you feel powerless. Me too. You know, it reminds me of that old bumper sticker. If you aren't furious, you aren't paying attention. If you aren't totally freaked out right now, I don't think that you're paying attention, because the evidence is all around us that this situation is hopeless. But hope, fortunately, means two different things. One kind of hope, passive hope, is for something you know will probably happen. I hope I can find a parking space at Old Navy. Well, there are thousands of them. You will. It's like wishing on a sure bet. You already know it's going to happen. This kind of hope is great if your priority is to not be disappointed. If you look at hope as a kind of bet you really want to win, then hope isn't going to help you be a Shambhala warrior. But the second kind of hope will, and this kind of hope is called active hope. And it's like desire. It's like aching for the world to heal. It's like aching for justice. Waiting for the world to change from this destructive path and wanting it so bad that you can see what it'll be like when it happens. It's not about knowing your effort will pay off, but about choosing to move in the direction of change. Fortunately, it does not require optimism. Thank goodness. Active hope doesn't even mind if we feel overwhelmed or powerless. It's choosing to be powerful in all your actions rather than powerless. It's picking an intention even if it feels impossible. This kind of hope takes courage because the arc of our universe is long, and we could work as hard as we can and never see the change that will come after we die. But we don't hope in order to march in the victory parade. We don't hope waiting for ticker tape recognition on the street. We hope because despair isn't a way to live. The opposite of hope is bitter and infectious poison, and it will kill you in an instant or over long, agonizing years. Instead, we use our courage to hope for things that we can't quite see yet. I really love the book To Kill a Mockingbird. You remember that from elementary school or middle school? Or Harper Lee wrote, "I wanted you to see what real courage is, instead of getting the idea that courage is a man with a gun in his hand. Courage is when you know you're licked before you even begin, but you begin anyway, and you see it through no matter what. Active hope. Hope without a clear outcome. Hope that is not a safe bet." This sermon is the first in a series of four, all about sustainable hope. This came about because I'm so lucky to be a part of your lives and to hear from you one-on-one what worries you and what concerns you. And over the past 3 years, what I've heard over and over again is that it feels impossible to be hopeful, that it feels sacrilegious to be happy when you know what the world is really like. That you feel like the environment has hit the proverbial fan, and how could you worry about fun things? When it seems like corporations own politics, like no one in office is advocating for water or air or the poor or even the middle class, that it seems like the options are A, be aware of all the injustice and be miserable, or B, hole up with your family and try to ignore reality. Build a soul bunker with walls thick enough to not let any cold reality come through. But there's a third way, and that's the way we're going to concentrate on. We're going to practice active hope, as inspired by the deep ecologist and author Joanna Macy and the mental health doctor who pioneered resilience therapy, Chris Johnston. And the first step in this active hope is cultivating gratitude so that our anger and our frustration and our fear don't overtake us. Now, I admit when I heard that this was the first step, I thought, oh, big deal. Like, me being grateful is really going to help anything. It feels so small. But gratitude is going to build us up so we can be Shambhala warriors. First, gratitude feels good. For the past few years, I've kept a gratitude journal by my nightstand, and every night I write down three or four things that I'm grateful for. Sometimes they're small. I'm glad that Jay made my favorite dinner of peanut noodles. I'm glad it was sunny this afternoon and I got off early enough to take a walk. Or big things, like my best friend got her dream job. And it really changes my perspective on how the day's gone. And therefore, my perspective on how my life is going. I'm more able to remember positive aspects of things, and my focus is there instead of on life's drearier things like, oh, I've got to get an oil change, or I didn't make it to the grocery store tonight, or my library books are overdue. I'm not thinking about that because I'm thinking, wow, the tulips in the yard do look amazing. Perhaps more surprisingly is that gratitude pulls us away from consumerism. Gratitude encourages satisfaction with what you already have. Advertising does the opposite. The goal of advertising is to make us feel like something is lacking and that we need that product to be happy or even just to be whole. In 1995, there were no recorded cases of bulimia in the island nation of Fuji. In 1995, Fuji got television. And by 1998, 11% of young Fijian women were bulimic. Why? Because advertising told them that their bodies weren't good, that they weren't right. Advertising convinces us that we lack some essential element, and we can't be happy until we have a product to fill that hole. But even if we buy the eyeliner or the lawnmower or the minivan, we realize that we still aren't happy. Gratitude fills that emptiness. The trick is, the more grateful you are, the less likely you are to think that you need things that the marketers want you to need. Gratitude makes us feel spiritually full, and that fullness is necessary if we're going to face head-on the destruction of our planet. So stay tuned. Next week, I'll be on the CBEC retreat with many of you. I'm very excited. And I'm leading the youth program. And then the Sunday after that, Bridget will be leading a sermon on how we can work with people that are unlike us, religiously, evangelicals, things like that, people who are unlike us on building a better world. And then, on May 10th, I'm going to talk about how we can honor our pain and our rage, which is our second step in becoming Shambhala warriors. We're going to let it all out. On May 17th, we're going to practice seeing the world with new eyes. And on May 24th, we're going to move forward. We're going to have a plan. Our souls will be ready to defend the earth and her people. And we aren't going to bow to misery. And we aren't going to sacrifice our own well-being. But for this week, my dear church family, this week we practice gratitude. Like any art, trying to learn the guitar or Tai Chi, you have to work on it until it feels natural. Jotting down a few thoughts before bed helps me. Maybe you want to sketch a few things in your sketch pad that you're grateful for. Maybe the best way for you is at every red light to think of something to be grateful for. You haven't been rear-ended. The air smells sweet. You probably aren't really running that late. Some minister friends of mine practice gratitude while they brush their teeth in the morning and evening. That's time you're not using for anything else, I imagine. And they think of as many things as they can in the 2 or 3 minutes that they're scrubbing away. But it matters that we do this step in a serious way. It matters that it's a daily practice, because the next few steps are tougher, and this gratitude practice is going to make you ready for it. We've got a couple of weeks to build an outlook of gratitude to see us through this process. my fellow reluctant leaders. We don't have to lead the nation or even leave the Shire to be Shambhala warriors. But we will need every bit of our active hope and our well-practiced gratitude. Do not despair. The arc of our moral universe is long, and we can bend it toward justice.